Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Well, hello there and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments. God Bless Our Pope, musical notes to mark the feast of Saints Peter and Paul. Spinning the tale of Saint Paul or Saul. The abbot of the Benedictine Monastery of St. Paul's Outside the Walls, Edmund Power, shines the spotlight on the Pauline year for us. And our popular Latin lover chats of the Mamertine prison, where legend has it St. Paul and St. Peter were once inmates. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. Sunday marks the feast of Saints Peter and Paul. And that's, as you'll have guessed, exactly what I'll be doing in the course of this programme, beginning with a musical tribute dedicated to the successor of Peter. For this, we turn to our music historian, Monsignor Philip Whitmore.
I was 26 years old when I entered the seminary in London. To an earlier generation, that would have seemed a pretty late start. A priest by the name of Nicholas Wiseman was exactly the same age when he became rector of the English College here in Rome in 1828. Already by that stage he'd made a name for himself as a scholar of Oriental languages. Obviously what you might call a high flyer. At that time, England was still considered missionary territory, and the scattered Catholic population was under the care of vicars apostolic. In 1840, Wiseman returned to England to assist the Vicar Apostolic in the Midlands. 10 years later, Pope Pius IX set up 13 fully-fledged Catholic dioceses in England and Wales. He made Nicholas Wiseman the first Archbishop of Westminster and a cardinal. In addition to his many other gifts as a churchman and a scholar, Wiseman dabbled in literature. He actually wrote a novel called Fabiola, or The Church of the Catacombs. And he wrote the text of the hymn, Full in the Panting Heart of Rome. Wiseman was nothing if not flamboyant. He ruffled quite a few feathers in the British establishment with his pastoral letter Out of the Flaminian Gate, speaking of the powers of government granted him by the Pope over English territory. That same flamboyant language is used all through this hymn. The golden roof, the marble walls, the Vatican's majestic halls, the note redouble till it fills with echoes sweet the seven hills. And he's particularly keen to underline the loyalty of the Pope's Catholic subjects in England. From torrid south to frozen north, that wave harmonious stretches forth, yet strikes no chord more true to Rome's than rings within our hearts and homes. The electric telegraph had been invented by Samuel Morse in the 1840s. Always eager to use vivid and up-to-date imagery, Wiseman makes reference to it in the last verse of God Bless Our Pope. This final verse is so completely over the top that nobody prints it these days. I found it in a 1932 hymn book that belonged to my parents. It goes like this. For like the sparks of unseen fire that speak along the magic wire, from home to home, from heart to heart, these words of countless children dart. There's nothing like a few really topical references to bring your message home. The trouble is, after 150 years, they lose some of their impact. You can see why most editors skip that verse. The Feast of Saints Peter and Paul is one when our thoughts turn particularly to the city of Rome. The city where those great apostles were martyred, and where they've been venerated ever since the first century. What Wiseman calls the apostles' crowning dome, Michelangelo's great masterpiece, is a familiar sight to anyone who's visited Rome. So June the 29th is a real Roman feast day, and it's an occasion when Catholics all over the world reaffirm their loyalty and their love towards Peter's successor. Viva il Papa! God bless our Pope.
My thanks there go to Monsignor Philip Whitmore. Monsignor Whitmore is a music historian currently working at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. And now, as I said earlier, I've chosen to focus on the figure of St. Paul as a special year dedicated to this towering figure from our family tree of faith is about to begin precisely on the 28th of June here in Rome, although celebrations began in the city of Tarsus, the birthplace of St. Paul in modern-day Turkey, last weekend. So if you wish to know more about St. Paul, stay tuned as our scripture scholar Mark Coleridge, Archbishop of Canberra, and Goulburn spins this story.
Saul was his Semitic name. Paul was the Roman name that he had from day one. He would have used Paul when he went to school or out into the marketplace. Saul would have been the name used at home. Now, we are dealing with one of the most vivid and overwhelming characters of the New Testament. He leaps off the page at you, like Jeremiah in the Old Testament. And this is amazing in an ancient world that didn't value personality and individuality as we do. Well, this is personality with a capital P. Who was he? He was a diaspora Jew of wealthy background. How do we know he was from a wealthy background? Two reasons. One, he was highly educated. And education tends to be always the privilege of the better off. And we also know that his parents were Roman citizens. Well, the only way that diaspora Jews could become Roman citizens was to pay a lot of money. So Paul was not one of your urban poor. He was from an urban, well-off background and born into a city that was renowned as a cultural and academic centre. At an early age, he went to Jerusalem to pursue his Pharisaic, his religious studies. Probably lived with relatives in Jerusalem. He becomes a well-known and respected figure as he grows older, and eventually he tells us he persecuted the Christians, so zealous was he for the faith of his ancestors. Then comes the fateful moment on the road to Damascus. What that moment was is hard to say, and Paul will spend the rest of his life unpacking the answer to the question, what does it mean, this overwhelming encounter with Jesus who came at him like a tidal wave? So overwhelming is the experience of encounter with Jesus, the one whom he had persecuted, that he goes off into the desert for 2 years or thereabouts. He calls it Arabia, but it's the desert area south of Damascus in modern-day Jordan. What was he doing? He doesn't tell us. But we can guess that he was simply grappling with the question, what does this mean, this experience of encounter? And the rest of his life will give his answer to that question. We then know for a fact that he went to Jerusalem for 2 weeks, he says, to exchange information with Peter. From Peter he needed to hear about Jesus, because Paul had never met Jesus face to face. Peter also needed to hear from Paul, because there were all kinds of stories circulating about Paul. There always were. So Paul had to say, now listen to me, not them. So 2 weeks in Jerusalem, and then they agree that he should go home to Tarsus. Strategic withdrawal for the time being. But in fact, he's back in Tarsus, it seems, for about 7 years. And it's Barnabas, whom we met last time, who brings Paul back onto the stage to the point where Paul becomes a member of that first ever missionary team, but not the leader. Then there's the big split with Barnabas and with Peter, it must be said, the brawl in Antioch over that issue of how Jewish and Gentile Christians should relate to each other. At this point, Paul has to make a big decision. Does he just go home, say it's all a bad joke, or what? He decides, in fact, not to go home, but to set up his own independent missionary team. And at this point, you can hear them howling in the background. Sore loser, megalomaniac, empire builder, false apostle. And these were the cries that would dog Paul throughout his apostolic career. The independent mission will take him into Europe, because Paul regards himself as called to go where no one else has gone. So he crosses the Hellespont from Asia into Europe, and there he begins a life of constant journeying, ceaseless travelling, but also ceaseless suffering. In fact, Paul's apostolic career is so much a story of suffering that you've got to ask, why didn't he at some point just pack up and go home, give it all up? The answer is strange and wonderful, and it's that Paul comes to see that the very thing that should destroy him, like persecution, like imprisonment, are the things that are strangely giving his mission power, giving life to him as an apostle. So he sees that his whole ministry and career are like the death of Jesus. It should have been the end, but it was the beginning. It should have destroyed Jesus, but it had the opposite effect. So Paul comes to see that the wound becomes a fountain. And that's the key to understanding him and why he didn't go home. All of his journeying leads to his beheading down in what's called Tre Fontane, here in Rome. And then he is taken by his disciples, the Christians of Rome, and buried not too far away. And once again, as with Peter, they put over his grave a huge and magnificent basilica, San Paolo fuori le mura, which simply spells out the magnificence of the witness that Paul gave, not only in life, but more particularly in death. What we see too is that in his death he finds his way to Peter, and that's why they're so often represented together. Here in Rome you will never see Peter without Paul, and you'll never see Paul without Peter, because in their martyrdom, in this one city, they find their way to each other completely, because they find their way completely to Jesus. So, you and I presume that you, like myself, were not born Jewish. Insofar as that is true, we are all, in a very strict sense, sons and daughters of St. Paul, sons and daughters of the great Gentile mission, which in the face of all opposition, he pursued through life and beyond death.
Our thanks there go to scripture scholar Mark Coleridge, Archbishop of Canberra and Goulburn. And now he's put us into the picture, let's focus for a moment on the actual Jubilee year to mark 2,000 years since the birth of St. Paul, which will be solemnly inaugurated on Saturday 28th of June, on the eve of the feasts of Saints Peter and Paul, by Benedict XVI, in the very same venue where he first called it, that's to say the Basilica of St. Paul's outside the walls.
Il giugno prossimo si aprirà l'anno consacrato alla testimonianza e all'insegnamento dell'Apostolo Paolo.
An occasion in which he went on to highlight in a special way how the Pauline year will be ecumenical, in an effort to reflect Paul's commitment to the unity and harmony among all Christians. Oh. According to the common opinion of the experts and unopposed tradition, the Basilica of St. Paul's outside the walls holds the remains of the Apostle Paul. But to find out more about the Pauline year, let's turn to the abbot of the Benedictine Monastery of St. Paul's outside the walls, Edmund Power.
We know that Paul is an apostle without limits to his vision. From the very beginning, it was he who believed that the gospel was for all nations, whereas the other apostles needed quite a lot of convincing to accept that. I think that fact means that Paul has been kind of venerated in a particular way by all branches of the whole Christian communion, whether Protestant, Orthodox, or Catholic. And I think that fact, that he's not anybody in particular's possession, means that he's a very good apostle, his eye always on Christ, his eye always on the mission. And of course, the mission of Christianity is one of the main reasons why we have to have unity, not only because Christ prayed for it, which is a good enough reason in itself, but also because if we are to preach the gospel as Christ asked us to do, we have to do it together in today's world. We probably had to do it together always, but history has shown that there's been these divisions. So Paul is a particularly good patron, I would say, and the fact that this is his burial place and his shrine means that this basilica takes on something of his charism.
Pope Benedict called for a Pauline year. Obviously, you, as the abbot of a church where St. Paul is buried, will be heavily involved in events planned for this Pauline year. Can you give me an outline of plans made so far?
Yes, in fact, the monastic community is involved. We'll be involved in particular at the pastoral and liturgical level. Our main responsibility is the care of the basilica, the pastoral care of the basilica. That means the confessions, the masses, the welcome of pilgrim groups and so on. And that takes a lot of time. And it will take far more time in the Pauline year. So we'll be fully involved in our normal pastoral work, but writ large. But there are a lot of other things organised, and the other aspects are being coordinated more by the office of the Archpriest of the Basilica. His assistants have established a website for the Basilica for the Pauline year, and that website will be regularly updated and will have all the events that will be going on in the course of the year. Obviously, a number of things have already been planned, various cultural activities, for example, exhibitions of various kinds associated with Paul, concerts, talks on St. Paul and so on. And also we've got a number of other things loosely connected with the Basilica, like the Pauline itinerary, a walk around Rome, around the places associated with Paul. It's true that the celebration is not exclusive to us here at the Basilica. In fact, there are 6 Catholic dioceses in the world that are dedicated to St. Paul directly, and they'll be involved as well, and many other churches and parishes dedicated to St. Paul throughout the world. But it's clear that the Basilica of St. Paul, as the primary shrine of the Apostle, will have a particular place and will be a particular destination for the many pilgrim groups who we anticipate will come to Rome during that year.
I've heard, correct me if I'm wrong, that you're going to open your Holy Door, which became famous worldwide when Pope John Paul II met with leaders of other Christian churches in St. Paul's during the year 2000, accomplishing that ritual gesture of opening that special door, no longer as tradition ruled alone, but remarkably together with the Archbishop of Canterbury in those days, Dr. George Carey, and a representative of the Orthodox Patriarch of Constantinople. Is it correct that you're going to open the Holy Door?
No, it's not correct, but it's not totally incorrect, and I'll explain. In fact, the Holy Door, which, there's 4 Holy Doors in Rome attached to the 4 major basilicas, they're only opened in the Holy Year. The Holy Year is the last one with the year 2000, of course, the Jubilee Year. It's for the whole church. It's not limited to any particular basilica or any particular saint. It's a proclamation of a year of grace for the whole church, a general year. And in those years, the Holy Door is opened. But it was decided that this is a particular year, the year of St. Paul, and it's not a year to open the Holy Door. But what we're going to do instead, those who know our basilica, if they imagine themselves in the four-sided walk in front of the main entrance of the basilica, facing the main entrance, there's the big, huge door in the centre, and there are two doors on either side, five doors altogether. The holy door is the first one on the right as you're facing that main door. The first one on the left, however, is never opened. And we're going to declare that the door of St. Paul, the Pauline door. And that will be open. The basic structure of this liturgy is the office of the Roman Rite, the Feast of the Conversion of St. Paul. There certainly will have been a considerable input on the part of the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity, which is very involved in this because it's an ecumenical occasion in the sense that representatives of other churches are invited. So maybe the choice of readings, the reflections and so on that they've participated in. But the only thing we do is to actually perform the liturgy, to sing certain sections of it and so on. It is the main occasion when the Holy Father comes to St. Paul's, and we've got a great devotion to the Apostle Paul. And so it's always a joy that his sanctuary and shrine should be the place where Christians yearn and pray for the unity for which Christ prayed.
And a big thank you there to the abbot of the Benedictine Monastery of St. Paul's Outside the Walls, Edmund Power. Meanwhile, on a totally different note, it's time for our weekly rendezvous with our popular Latin lover. And guess where he's taking us today? A place linked in a legendary manner to the figure of St. Paul, but also St. Peter. Don't miss this scholarly, light-hearted entertainment with Carmelite Father Reginald Foster. Father Foster, I'd like to speak about gloom and doom at the foot of the Capitoline Hill today.
What is that?
How do you say gloom and doom?
What is gloom and doom? Mestizia et tragedia.
I want to speak about dungeons.
Oh, Lord. Oh, the Mamertine prison.
Are you? You're good at guessing.
Well, that's easy.
You have to go down the moaning steps.
Yeah, coming down from the Capitoline Hill.
What are they called in Latin?
Gemoniae. Scale Gemoniae.
Why are they called the Moaning Steps?
Because people were taken down there in tears and so forth, suffering to be thrown into prison. Like you have in Venice, too, don't you? Have a moaning, a bridge of
Bridge of Sighs.
Oh, that's about much the same thing.
How do you say Bridge of Sighs?
Single torum our sighs. No. Suspiriorum, the bridge of Pons Suspiriorum.
Mamertinus is a medieval name. No, that's not Latin, is it?
We don't even know where it comes from, you know.
Is it true that the Roman law didn't recognize imprisonment as punishment?
Just about.
In the sense that it was a sort of death row.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. Exactly.
How do you say death row in
death
Latin?
Death row is morituorum ordo, a line of people about to die. Oh, everything sounds better in Latin. You could start it in papal encyclical with morituorum ordo. Death row. Sounds so glorious. Latin always sounds glorious.
Why do you think a papal encyclical would sound so glorious about death row?
Well, no, you wouldn't know what the encyclical's about. But the title sounds so magnificent. Morituorum ordo.
How would you say electric chair?
I know. Sedes electrica, we would have to say.
Yeah, but they didn't have electricity.
I understand, but no, they had the... Because electris in Greek is ember. And they thought that spark came from the jewel ember. And so electricus is coming from amber. You know the yellow jewel?
Amber.
Mm. That's where the whole thing comes from. And they thought that spark or that force came from that jewel, that yellow jewel, amber.
They didn't.
Well, it did, but but that's what they thought. That's where you get electricals from. No one knows anything.
How'd you say dead man walking? That's easy.
Well, that's easy. Mortuus ambulans.
A lethal injection?
Oh, Lord, delivers in, letalis. You're going to have to, letalis is Greek, too. Letalis injectio.
Among the many inmates, you know that I was going to ask you this question. According to legend, were saints Peter and Paul.
Yeah, the legend. I warn people, be careful. And there's an armed window, and Peter and Paul are spooking out of the window.
How do you say Peter and Paul spooking out of the window?
Speculantes, Petrus Paulusque, de Fenestra Speculantes.
We went there once together, you know, down to the Mamertine prison.
Really? Oh, my lord, that's about 15 years ago.
What struck me was it was so tiny.
Well, they didn't spend much time down there. You know, you were there kind of in chick-chick-chick-chick. In a couple of days, chick-chick-chick. And there was a door there which was attached to the sewer.
How'd you say chick-chick-chick in Latin?
Chick-chick-chick. I don't know what. Anyway, and so people would kind of finish their earthly days and be thrown right into the sewer out of the Tiber. So it wasn't a place for detention. I mean, detention, but not long. Like 30 years? No, 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 no. 2-3 days, bing, 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 that was the end of it.
There are various Romans who wrote about the Mamertine prisons, like Livy, who said that a prison was built in the midst of the city above the Forum.
Exactly, I remember the text.
But it's
Media urbe supra Forum Romanum, which means the level. You see, now it's below the ground. But in those days, it was higher than the level of the Forum below it.
And then Sallustius, he said, it's a place where neglect, darkness, and stench make it hideous and fearsome to behold.
Psitus et tenebrae et fetor, I think he uses fetor.
We say fetid today, don't we?
Yeah, certainly.
Make it hideous and fearsome to behold.
Visu horridum et terrificum.
What likelihood is there that Paul may really have been an inmate there?
All that we have here is the Acts of the Apostles. And really it doesn't correspond to their prison because the Acts of the Apostles said he was like in some sort of a house confinement. You know, he was a prisoner at home with maybe a Roman soldier out at the front door. He wasn't in prison, really.
But in the Philippians, Paul writes, it has become known throughout the whole Praetorian Guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ.
Yeah, and what he means by imprisonment, is a house arrest, is that imprisonment or not?
How do you say house arrest?
House arrest, carcer domesticus.
Mm. So they weren't inmates. How do you say inmate?
Incule, or we're going to say incule, okay. Well, I don't know, they weren't for sure. I mean, who knows? You know, there's a big question whether Peter was ever in Rome anyway.
But they say he was crucified upside down in Nero's circus on the Vatican Hill.
Yeah, that's all nice talk.
That's not true.
I don't say it's not true, I just don't know.
Well, there's a grave, the grave of St. Peter.
That's another story, but crucified upside down and Michelangelo's painting and everything else. You have to be kind of careful about this stuff. There's so many stories that came up, you know, over 1,500 years.
But his grave is beneath St. Peter's.
That's all right.
Whereas St. Paul was beheaded at the Aquas Salvia, no?
Out there and here, yeah. So they say.
But this is a Pauline year, no? How do you say the Pauline year? Kicks off.
Incipit Paulinus Annus.
At the will of Pope Benedict XVI.
Benedicti Decimi Sexti Voluntate.
What other places that are linked to St. Paul do you know in Rome? St. Paul's outside the walls?
Well, yeah, okay. Well, the Via Ostiense, going out to Ostia, but I don't really know.
Which is close to the place where he's said to have died and the three fountains sprung up.
Yeah, well, that's Tre Fontane out there. Which is not far away, it's behind, you know.
And Santa Prisca on the Aventine?
I don't know all these stories, I can't know all these stories.
He wanted to evangelize to the ends of the earth.
Exactly, that kind of enthusiasm of preaching the gospel I think is very inspiring.
How do you say, de finibus terre?
In finis terre, unto the ends of the earth.
What is de finibus terre?
From the ends of the earth, you know, like praise of the Lord from all the ends of the earth, from... De finibus is from the ends of the earth.
And heartfelt thanks there once again to our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, the Pope's very own Latinist. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org.
Laudator Jesus Christus.